Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every day on the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my good guests. My guest today is Nori Nakamura, who is the owner and winemaker at the Noria, a unique winery in California. When we eat Japanese food, we almost automatically think to pair it with Japanese sake or Japanese beer. On the other hand, Japanese sake has become so popular globally that you can find it at the Michelin-starred non-Japanese restaurants outside of Japan these days. Nori decided to break the preconception and now is making beautiful wine that pairs perfectly with Japanese food. So today we'll discuss how Nori, who used to be in the high-end hotel industry in Japan, became a winemaker, his winemaking philosophy, what types of wine go well with Japanese food, the future of Japanese food and wine pairings, and much, much more. But before we start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Nori Nakamura. Hello, Nori. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is exciting. So to get to know you, first of all, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
Yes, I was originally from Tokyo, Japan. And actually, I'm Edoko. I'm three generations all living in Tokyo. And I was lucky because my parents were foodies. So pretty much every weekend, they took us to like somewhere, like basically we ate out. So it's many different kind of food, like Italian food, Chinese food, of course, Japanese food. That's how I grew up eating.
Right. Interesting. The word edoko. Edoko is, you know, the Edo period, and it's like 17th to the 19th century of Tokyo. And there are like, usually people say New Yorkers are very similar to edoko because there's a quick and looking for something new and kind of easy to fight on. Kind of
right.
So, but you don't seem to be very quick and fighting oriented.
No, I'm okay. I'm kind of a metal person. Nobody.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. But you know, the Tokyo Edoko is very open-minded and always looking for something innovative. And I really think it's a very cool thing. And
yeah, I think we like something new. Yes.
Right.
For sure.
Okay. So, and then, so from Tokyo, you moved to the States. So when and why did you move to the US?
Yeah, that was back in 1999, the January, I still remember January 8th, because I used to work for the hotel management company. It's called JAL Hotels under the Japan Airline. And when I graduated from college in Japan, I started working for the company and I moved around within Japan. And then 1999, my company told me that, hey, Nori, there's a position open in San Francisco. There's a hotel called Hotel Nikko San Francisco, near downtown. So basically, I was sent by company to come to United States. So it was nothing to do with wine.
Yet. Right.
Yet.
Right. So, but then how did you get into wine and winemaking?
Yeah. So the wine was, that was more like when I was younger. So my uncle used to own an Italian restaurant in the middle of Tokyo. So my father's side of the family, when we got together, pretty much every time we went to that the restaurant. So to me, I was, so when I was like 5 years old, you know, 7 years old. So when I was that young. And to me, the restaurant was really, because everybody's having a good time, good conversation, good food. And there was always wine there too. So to me, the restaurant is really kind of special, fun space and fun time. So I really wanted to get into that. So when I graduated from college, I was thinking about, you know, what to do, what would be my career. And many of my friends were trying to look for a job in the big corporations, finance, trading company, but I was not interested in. I was very interested in something more like the restaurant. But to find a restaurant to work for in Tokyo is almost, because there are so many choices, right? So many restaurants there. So I couldn't figure out what to do. And then I came up with the idea to work for hotel because many of the big Japanese hotels house at least five, six restaurants within the building, like Japanese restaurant, Italian restaurant, French restaurant kind of stuff. So I thought by working for a hotel, I can work for a restaurant and then I can also study about the wine. So that's why I started working for a hotel.
Right. Well, I heard that when you moved to San Francisco, you were catering manager. So you were in a good position to observe everything, food and beverage.
That's right. Even though I couldn't speak English, but I was assigned as catering manager.
Right. So the food is the universal language. So that worked.
That's right.
Right. I also heard...
And then,
yeah, sorry.
Go ahead.
Because I heard your uncle was a famous opera singer. And
He was an opera singer.
He had a restaurant, an Italian restaurant.
Yeah, so he owned that restaurant for 40 years. I mean, he passed away already. But so he was Japanese opera singer. So he was always back and forth between Japan and Italy. And he was so influenced by, of course, the opera, but also food culture and the culture of Italy. So he fell in love with Italian food. So he decided to own a Italian restaurant in Japan.
Mm, right. Well, I really think that knowing Italian wines really is an advantage because there's so much diversity and you really learn not just what you put in your mouth, but the culture behind it, right?
That's right. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. So, but how did you study winemaking? Obviously, you are a winemaker. So.
Sorry, I didn't go there yet. So I came here, right, as the catering manager to work for the hotel, and I was living in San Francisco. And so I did have opportunity to come to Napa and Sonoma because it was only like 45 minutes to 1 hour drive from San Francisco. So I was not really familiar with California wine back then. It's like 25 years ago, because I did study about the wine while I was working in hotels in Japan. I went to sommelier school, learned about, did a lot of blind tasting, but I would say like 98% are about French wine. And then I didn't really know anything about the California wine when I moved here. So I took my opportunity to come to Napa Sonoma almost every weekend because it was new to me. It was very exciting because I feel like I was gaining some new, getting to know more about the California, which is completely different from like the French wine, Italian wine. So I enjoyed it. And then I decided, the making wine is something I really want to do. So Napa Sonoma, I mean, my experience living in San Francisco made me decide my new career.
Mm. Right. So, and then you went to the notable UC Davis. Well, that's like, Harvard.
That's right.
Winemaking.
Yeah. So it's very interesting because So when I was working at the Hotel Nikko San Francisco in San Francisco, my first year, I went to almost like 170 wineries in Napa and Sonoma because I really wanted to learn more about the California wine. And normally when I go there as a regular customer, then I go to the tasting room, talk to the people who work in the tasting room, right? But sometimes, once in a while, I was able to meet winemakers. And I always asked them same questions. And my question was, how did you learn winemaking? Because it was really, I couldn't figure out how they did it. Because especially in California, you see many, like the big wineries, they are corporations, right? So they hire winemakers as employees. And so I didn't know how they got the experience and knowledge of the winemaking. So I always asked the same question to the winemakers. And pretty much I would say like 85% of answers were like, oh, I went to UC Davis. And then like, what is UC Davis? I didn't know anything about UC Davis. I started research and then, oh, wow, there's a school, there's a college that you can study about the winemaking. Basically, it's called viticulture and enology. Viticulture is grape growing. Enology is wine fermentation science. So when I saw it, when I learned about it, I'm like, oh, this is to get the degree of viticulture and enology will be my entrance to this industry. So I worked basically study about it. I had to do many prerequisite because viticulture enology is a BS, Bachelor of Science, but my background in Japan was BA, Bachelor of Art. So I had to take some science classes before I moved into the program.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of studying.
It was, yeah.
Right, because the wine really is a science, and the more you know, I think more you have to learn, and all those, along with everything else, like local nature, grapes, and techniques, and marketing to everything. So I'm very impressed at how much you came to this point.
Yeah, I was very focused at the time, yes.
Right. And then after you graduated from UC Davis, you worked at a couple notable wineries in the area. So, So where did you work and what did you learn at each place?
Yeah, I worked at several wineries. So even when I was going to UC Davis, I started working. I took the seasonal job during the harvest. So my first two is Cobbs Newland. Cobbs Newland doesn't exist anymore. In Napa, small winery in Napa, and then I worked at the Pine Ridge as well. Those are as a cellar worker, so I was basically bottom work, moving the barrels, cleaning the tanks, those kind of stuff, right? And then my third winery, I worked for Napa Wine Company, which is very traditional, historical, big winery in Napa, but they don't really make their own wine. It's called Custom Crush Facility. So a lot of winemakers who don't have winemaking facility, they bring in their grapes there and then make their own wine using Napa Wine Company's stuff. So I was in the lab there. So I was able to meet many winemakers, like I would say 50 different winemakers, and I was able to talk to them, learn about their philosophies, and also I was in the lab, so I was always I had experience to taste their wine because all the samples come to lab, right? So I was cranking up the numbers, talking about the pH, acidity, those alcohol, those kind of stuff. But at the end, I sip the wine, the sample, to learn more about the wine. And so that was really great experience by working for one winery, but it was very substantial experience for me. And then I moved to different winery because at the time I was working at the Napa Wine Company, but so I gained a lot of experience by interfering with those winemakers. But at the end, I felt like I really want to work for one winery so that I can put my 100% effort to the wine the wines that winery make. So I moved on to Artesa Winery in Carneros, and I I soon became assistant winemaker there. So in 2005, so that was kind of really the beginning of my career as a winemaker. And there I really pretty much learned all about the winemaking, from grapes to how to handle the harvest and organizing the group of people, production, the bottling, and those kind of stuff. And then after that, I became a winemaker at the new winery. It's called Jameson Ranch for about 2 years. And then I moved to Larson Family Winery in Sonoma. And I was there for 7 years until December of last year as a winemaker.
Wow. You must have done really something right, because such a successful path. And yeah, congratulations.
Thank you so much. Yes. I was lucky. Yes.
Well, I think you work so hard. That's what I can say. All right. So we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into Nori's own wine that goes perfectly with Japanese food. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Coming this spring, we're working on something big for opening soon.
Opening a restaurant can sometimes take months or even years.
So I have this one consulting client that's been 3 months away from opening for the past year.
And I had a calendar reminder show up today, and the reminder was that our goal was to open tomorrow.
But this spring, you'll be able to hear it in just a few hours.
On March 30th, he had passed away. And then on March 31st, he had come back to life. And then on April 2nd, he had passed away again. And I was like, okay, my regards to the family. I don't even know how to receive this information.
So tune in as we follow one of Brooklyn's best and brightest young chefs and restaurateurs on their journey from start to open doors.
Alex, you need to put more money in. We're out. We can't pay anybody.
He is the bratwurst. Oh my God, that guy.
It's The Build.
Subscribe to Opening Soon from Heritage Radio Network, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs on Heritage Radio Network, HRN. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Nori Nakamura. And he is the owner and winemaker at Noria, a unique winery in California. So there are great winemaking regions within the U.S. and in many other countries, of course, I mean, including Italy, maybe. But why did you decide to make wine in the U.S. and more specifically in California?
Yeah, that's simple, because I was in California. And then seriously, I think that's the simple answer and 100% true.
Right.
Yes.
And also, I think it's really like UC Davis to, you know, Napa Wine Company. I was impressed at how much you were able to learn from the lab. And you just really kind of you exposed the trade secrets, right? So I think it's the best
right.
place. Right.
Yeah, yeah. I was lucky too. Yes.
Okay. So, and you've been making your own wine since 2010, along with you work for other wineries. So, and the brand name that's called Noria. So what is Noria? What does it mean?
Yeah, so the Noria means water wheel in Spanish. And the first of all, I wanted to name my wine that has my name, which is Nori, so N-O-R-I. But just Nori sounds not good enough. It's like some seaweed, right? I mean, not that seaweed is bad, but seaweed is great. But so just I found that just by adding A at the end, N-O-R-I-A, Noria means water wheel in Spanish. So, I mean, it's not that I know anything about the water wheel, but to me, the image of water wheels are like the water, the nature, like the base energy of the life. Those are the elements that I can come up with. And I thought, to me, the elements of the wine are very similar to it. So I really like the name. So that's why I decided to call Noria. But at the same time, my wife's name is Maria. And so this Noria idea, name of the Noria, came from my wife. Because Nori and Maria is Noria. So that's also another reason having this name.
Right. Perfect. Yeah, I like the name a lot. Okay, so I didn't know that, your wife and husband part of it. That's beautiful.
Yes.
Right. So, and you aim to produce wine that goes well with Japanese food, which is clearly stated on your website. So mm-hmm. What flavor profile of the wines is ideal for pairing with Japanese food?
Yes. So the concept of Noria is clearly to produce California wine that can go well with Japanese food. And to me, the definition, because Japanese food is a lot, there's so many wide range of food. It's not just sushi, but there's so many different kind of food. So to me, the definition of Japanese food, foods are like elegant dishes made from seasonal and fresh ingredients. So to me, I like to make the wine that can have the same wavelengths, the freshness, vibrancy to the Japanese food. So I can break down into more further, but for good example are my white wine. I make Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay under Noria, but those wines, Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay, I'm not modeling after someone else's Sauvignon Blanc or Chardonnay, but I'm trying to go after the flavor the flavor of the sake. So the Sauvignon Blanc, I'm modeling after Daiginjo style sake. And for my Chardonnay, I'm modeling after Junmai Ginjo sake. So that's I believe that it can be paired well with Japanese food.
Right. So for example, your Sauvignon Blanc, it's the purpose. There's some sections and a purpose. Yeah, you said it's the Sauvignon Blanc modeled after the style of Japanese sake called Daiginjo. And the personality, it's about the grapefruit, lime, pear, hint of lychee, orange zest, bay leaf, flintstone, a lot of descriptions. And this pairs with tempura and white fish, sashimi, cured kombu. And it really makes sense, right? So yeah, that's, I'm really impressed that the whole description of what's here. And people tend to think California wines, people used to be like more big and bold, which I think is changing. So
it is. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So it's impressive that you're kind of creating a new genre of Californian wine.
Mm-hmm. I think it's fun to discover the potential of California wine. I really believe that I think it's used to be people make there used to be that the winemaking in California, it's all about the power and the ripe fruits, a lot of oak kind of stuff. But if you kind of tone down those elements, then when you try to show more the quality of the fruits, it really stands out. Talking about the quality potential. Quality and the potential of the California wine. Mm. So that's why I really believe that California wine has great potential to make wine that can be paired with very delicate dishes.
Mm. Right. And I think they kind of suspended efforts, but there's a group of young winemakers who tried to change the perception of big and bold Californian style wines, more subtle, delicate. And I think your efforts are in line with what they've been doing, because California mm-hmm. has huge potential to express in diverse, very excellent ways to make wine. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I'm really curious what you keep making. So, Yeah, and the ingredients are the key to the to your wine, of course. And where do you get your grapes from? And what is special about these grapes?
Yeah, those are, so because I don't own a vineyard, so I have to basically buy grapes from the growers. So, of course, when you kind of picture a winery, normally you can picture a like the chateau kind of like the building there where you make wine, where you produce wine. But that chateau or building is surrounded by the vineyard, which is a state vineyard that winery owner also owns, right? But to me, for my case, I don't really own a own vineyard, so I need to purchase from the different growers. In California, there are a lot of grape growers who grow grapes, but a lot of people don't make wine out of their own grapes. They basically sell the grapes to the winemakers. So we buy and then bring that to a winemaking facility, such as Napa Wine Company, and then we can make wine. So this is it's a system called Custom Crush. But because of this system, so I get to choose which vineyard. Of course, sometimes I cannot even get it because some vineyards are so popular. But the original idea is that 95% of style and the quality of the grapes, wine, come from the vineyard. So once you choose the vineyard, pretty much your wines are already set. Of course, you don't do a good job in the vineyard and the winery. Of course, your quality, you can easily lose the quality. But there's no magic to change the style and quality of the wine from the original vineyard. So it's very important. Most important thing to make my wine is to maintain a good relationship with the vineyard. And so basically how I chose those the vineyards is also going back to the concept of the pairing with the Japanese food. So in that concept, in my mind, for example, my Sauvignon Blanc, it's from it's called Beville Family Vineyard in a town called Sebastopol. This falls into Russian River AVA. But I was specifically looking for Sauvignon Blanc in this area, like the Sonoma side. At the time, I was working at the Altesa Winery located in Napa. So I had more opportunity to basically encounter the Sauvignon Blanc grown in Napa. But the Napa is a little bit warmer. So to me, Daiginjo style Sauvignon Blanc, if I want to make it, the Napa is too warm. The alcohol gets too high. You tend to lose a little bit more acidity. But I wanted to make the Sauvignon Blanc that is very crisp and smooth and the fruity. So I was looking for the Sauvignon Blanc from the Sonoma side, especially Russian River. So sometimes it takes a couple of years to find the actual grape and the vineyard that I really want. So that's the, but at the same time, it's very fun process. You have to be patient, because sometimes it takes years, but it's fun once you find it. And then when you make it, and then that is closer to what you really wanted. That's very fun process. So I went through all the, for my Sauvignon Blanc. Now I make 3 Pinot Noirs. From different vineyard, but I went through the same process to look for the particular like Chardonnay, particular Pinot Noir from particular area, because that's the tasting profile I wanted to create.
Interesting. Right, even within California, and there are many wine regions, and specifically you chose to be sourcing from Sonoma, which is known for very unique and delicate style, and then Russian River Valley, which I think you use grapes from a lot. There's like a foggy, and I was, you know, the temperature is slightly lower, and I was thinking like how Japanese sake is sensitive depending on the region, like in Niigata to Kyoto. So it's very terroir driven, and I think your mindset of making wine like sake, I found it's very interesting and fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. So what is the biggest challenge in making wines for you?
Yeah, I think this is the dealing with the nature. So it's just like a roller coasting experience, especially after 2017. There's a big fire and we lost grapes. And in 2000, pretty much every year after that, we have like small fire. And then 2020 was really, really, it damaged so many grapes. For example, like I would say like 85% of Sonoma Sato Pinot Noir, we couldn't pick. It's not because that all the vineyards did not get affected by fire, but by smoke. So fire happens somewhere else, but the smoke comes with the wind, and then it basically ruins the grapes. So the vines are healthy and okay, but it just directly affect the taste of the wine, grapes and wine. So dealing with the nature is always just the challenging thing for us.
Mm. Right. So what about the situation? I heard it's been raining in California a lot this year. Is that the same case with Sonoma, and it's better for...
Yeah. So a lot of wine during the winter is a really welcoming thing. So we're really happy about this kind of weird winter because a lot of rain happened this year. But it was really good for us as the growers and the winemakers in this area, in our industry. Because previous 2 years was a very dry and a drought year. So we really worried about another fire this year. So it's not that, you know, this rain in this winter fixed everything. No, it's not. We still have we have to be really careful. But it was really good thing that rain happened. Mm. A lot of rain happened here. Yes.
Right. That's exciting. So, and you're planning to open your own winery in Berkeley, California very soon. So what's the plan and what is going to be different from your existing operations?
Yes. So this is called Urban Winery. So it's not that a winery surrounded by the vineyard. Because I'm still purchasing the grapes from the same growers, so that won't change. But I'm trying to, basically I'm leasing a warehouse in Berkeley and then convert that into the winery. So I'm going to put all the equipment crushing, so I can crush there, ferment there with a stainless steel tank, and then I'm going to age the wine in barrels there. And then I have a tasting room to show my wine, and then the retail section as well. So it is a complete winery without the vineyard there. It's really a great opportunity for me because I've been making Noria wine for 13 years, but using renting basically the space from an existing winery and then using their stuff. So it's really nice and helpful, and it's an amazing system. It's called Custom Crest system. So I was able to, you know, I've been making wine using the system, but at the same time, once I have my own winery in Berkeley, basically everything can be under my control, and then I can gain more flexibility and more. So I can also come up with more experimental products, like the small portion of something, like the orange wine or something like that. Yeah, so that's very exciting for me. I have more opportunity to do more different stuff if I have my own winery. Yes.
Right. So when do you think it's going to open?
Oh, yeah. So originally I set the opening date as April 1st, but it didn't happen. So right now I'm looking at sometime in May. I'll say maybe mid-May. But I'm still waiting for the finalization of the permit. So it's all depending on the city of Berkeley, how the process goes. Yes.
Right. So the 2023 will be your first vintage for your own winery. So
yes.
That's exciting.
Yes. Yeah, so this year I'm going to produce all my wine under my own winery in Berkeley, yes.
Mm. Okay, so and then this is a little slightly bigger question, but sake is becoming very popular globally in recent years, and the sake export in 2022 was a record high, and export value increased by 5 times from 10 years ago, which is amazing, and people are drinking more expensive sake too. So, and also sake has started to be paired with non-Japanese food, because people, including high-end sommeliers, started to realize that non-Japanese food can go well, very well with sake. So, and if you go to Paris, I think you can find expensive daiginjo ginjo at the Michelin-starred restaurants, something like that. So, but people tend to think still that Japanese food is to be enjoyed mostly with sake or Japanese beer. This kind of makes sense. But what do you think of the opportunity for wine in terms of pairing with non-Japanese food?
For wine?
I mean, wine with Japanese food.
A wine with Japanese food.
Right. That's what I think you're trying to do, right?
Yeah. So, first of all, the Japanese culture, the food culture, has the tradition of taking alcohol, during the meal, right? So I don't see any difficulty of serving wine with Japanese food. It's just only the matter of how you create or what kind of wine you present with the meal. Like I said, the Japanese food in general, it's a harmony of so many different ingredients. They don't really make up with a lot of sauces, and it's more like the bare naked ingredients, but those ingredients in dishes have the nice harmony. So to me, if I can present the wine, that can really enhance that harmony. I think it'll be really enjoyable. Like good example, I would say is that a lot of people drink the big red wine with a steak, right? Because the tannin and acidity of the red wine, big red wine, can cut the fattiness of the steak, so you can refresh your mouth palate and then move on to the second bite. But my image of pairing my wine with Japanese food is opposite. I really don't want to cut the suppleness and the harmony of the food from the dishes. I like to take that and then move on to the next bite by using my wine as a kind of intermediator kind of stuff. So it's a little bit opposite mine compared to traditional wine pairing idea.
Interesting. I'm just looking at one of your Pinot Noir Sonoma Coast, and it pairs with sukiyaki and roasted duck and pork and pasta with tomato sauce. So it's kind of like, it makes sense that you merge the two instead of contrasting. It's more like complementary style of pairings. Yeah, that's interesting. And so by the way, where is your wine available? Do you tend to sell more to restaurants or retailers?
Yeah, it's mainly restaurants, like the Bay Area restaurants. So if a listener would like to purchase it, the best way is to go to my website, www.noriawines.com. You can purchase all of my wines through the website.
Mm, right. And then, so restaurants are more interested what's the biggest challenge in selling your wine to? Oh,
yeah, it's not easy. Making wine, I would say making wine is much easier than selling wine. So that's why I have so much respect towards, marketing and salespeople in this industry, because it's so tough because there's so many competitions. There's so many different labels and with high quality wine. So that's why to me, when I come up with this idea, the concept, I do care about the niche market so that And then when I also self-distribute my wine in California. So when I do that, I go to the restaurant. I targeted like high-end Japanese restaurants first, and then go there. Sometimes I bring my wine and have lunch, dinner there, and then open my wine, and then talk to the chef, wine buyers there, and then, you know, share the wine, and then try to arrange appointment for the tasting. And this is very time-taking, but I go through those process to sell wine. But because of my concepts, I always tell them that, you know, my wine should be paired with well with your food. Then I have more opportunity for them to open up. And then I have more opportunity to basically make appointment, you know, future appointment. And then so they can taste my wine. And then so at the end, it's much more like I have a higher, the percentage of selling my wine there that way because of the concept.
Right. Okay. So it's amazing. You have a list of where you can drink at, you know, restaurants of your wine. And then it's quite an achievement, right? Because it's Napa and Sonoma. It's just the home of all those amazing wine. And like you said, it's much competition going on. So yeah, it's very impressive. I haven't tasted your wine yet, to be honest, but it must be really good. So one day I hope to visit your new winery.
I'll send it to you. Yes. Oh, you please come. Yes.
Great. So, yeah. And so what is your plans and dreams for the future besides your upcoming opening of your own winery?
Yes. I like to focus on my new winery for the couple of years, maybe first couple of years. But I have a dream of expanding this style of like the wine, urban wineries to different like cities. Maybe like the New York, if I can do that, that would be so awesome. Or maybe like a Tokyo, if I can bring this idea of urban winery for Noria, and if I can open that in Tokyo, that would be great too. And then also one day, sometime near soon, I like to own a vineyard as well. Even though I just mentioned earlier that it's fun to purchase the grapes from the great growers, but it's also at the same time, it's really nice to have the flagship vineyard of my own vineyard and then make wine from there as well.
Right. There's a lot coming up. So, yeah, good luck.
Thank you.
Right. So, and where can we find your updates online and on social media if our listeners wants to know?
Yeah, so my website, noriawines.com, and then also the Facebook and the Instagram.
Great. All right, so thank you so much for joining us today, Nori. And again, good luck on the new opening as well as everything you just said. So you're amazing.
Thank you.
Right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritagevideonetwork.org or akikoatayama.com. Japanese is a weekly program and it's always available at heritagevideonetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Armin Spengen, and we'll take a spring break for the next few weeks, so we'll see you in May. Thank you for listening. Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.